Welcome to Across the Margin Podcast. This is your host, Michael Shields. Across the Margin Podcast is a proud member of the Osiris Media Group. Check out all their offerings, all their live events, everything they got going on at osirispod.com. In this episode, I present an interview with Los Angeles-based writer Will Hagel. Will is a co-host of the Connecting the Classics podcast, and a great deal of his work can be found on the webzine Passion of the Weiss. He is also the author of the excellent 33rd and a Third book dedicated to MF Doom and Mad Lib's album, Mad Villainy. The book, which is the focus of this episode, celebrates Mad Villainy as a representation of two genius musical minds melding to form one revered supervillain. A product of circumstance, the album came together soon after MF Doom's resurgence and Mad Lib's reluctant return from avant-garde jazz to hip-hop. Written from the alternating perspectives of three fake music journalist superheroes and featuring interviews with Wildchild, Cut Chemist, M.E.D., Wallasia, Stone's Throw executives, and many other real individuals involved with the album's creation, Will's book blends fiction and nonfiction to celebrate Mad Villainy not just as an album, but as a folkloric artifact. It is one specific retelling of a story which, like Mad Villain's music, continues to spawn infinite legends. So in this episode, Will and I discuss both Mad Lib and MF Doom's origin story while expounding at length what makes Mad Villainy such a special and enduring piece of art. We explore the somewhat disputed stories on how MF Doom and Mad Lib connected for the project and dig into how unique it was that Mad Villainy existed as an album that straddled the analog and digital eras. We celebrate the song Accordion as one of the most unparalleled songs in hip-hop history. We remark on Mad Villainy's profound influence in modern music and so much more. Will describes himself in the book as just a fan who wants to celebrate Doom, Mad Lib, and Mad Villainy's eternal unknowability. As both artists and the album's story are fascinating enigmas, ones that you can begin to make sense of after reading Will's book. And Mad Villainy's legacy is far-reaching and long-lasting. As Will states, Mad Villainy refined what an album could be. It truly changed music forever and highlighted the incomprehensible talents of its creators, Mad Lib and MF Doom. So I have no doubt you will enjoy this interview with Will Hagel.
Podcast.
Will, thank you for coming on the program. Absolutely love the book. It's great. Thank you.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here. Thanks for reading.
Of course. It's great. So you tell this story in a real unique way, and it kind of acts like a great hat tip, an ode to the album. It's got this comic book vibe. I think it would be a cool way to start to tell the listeners kind of this novel way that you told the story. There's some creative writing involved.
Yeah. So the book, you might have introed it already, is about Mad Villainy, MF Doom and Mad Lib's collaborative album from 2004 for the 33 and a Third series, which is books about albums. The album, as listeners may or may not know, is kind of told in a semi-fictional way. I guess both MF Doom and Mad Lib are both artists who use different characters, and they draw from comic books, like you said, throughout their music, and have like little world building aspects throughout their albums and their music and discographies and their kind of personas as artists. So when I was writing the book, I originally was kind of just writing, you know, a straightforward sort of history of the album and the artists. And I quickly realized that that doesn't really suit the artists or the albums that I'm discussing. And also, I like fiction writing probably more than nonfiction writing. And, you know, I work on novels in my spare time and short stories and stuff like that. So I kind of selfishly wanted to use this book as a way to do some more creative writing and fiction writing, like you said.
Yeah.
So essentially the framing of it is three different characters who are all related to each other, and they have little backstories throughout the book, and they all are writing for a fake music publication called The Daily Daily, and they're writing the story of Mad Villain together. And then there's also a little, I tried to make something, I guess, too, that is inspired by the album, but isn't just only about the album. I guess it is mostly about the album because that's obviously what people want to read.
Yeah.
But I also wanted to attempt to make something that stands apart from it in its own way a little bit, kind of how, you know, Madlib and Doom both sampled from artists of the past to make something new. So yeah. That was my attempt, at least.
Yeah, you weaved it in and out though with a whole lot of finesse. It was and it made it a lot of fun as well. I always think about, you know, writing one of these 33 and a third books, and you know, some kind of would you know, it'd be easy. Like you could just tackle this history, but with this one, like, I almost didn't envy you. I mean, it's such a unique story. These are people who, you know, kind of evade the mainstream, evade being known fully. So I was curious, you know, the challenges that you came upon or that you experienced in writing about this album and Doom and Madlib.
Yeah. So with Doom in particular, he's someone who has a very passionate fan base who respects, like myself included, respects his kind of mysteriousness because that's what attracts people to him. And Madlib is very similar in a different way. Mm. Whereas, you know, a lot of people I talk to would say Doom and Madlib both had like similar sensibilities, but in kind of an opposite manner. Whereas Doom, you know, like he was a very outgoing person in his, like the Daniel Dumoulin, who performed as MF Doom, was an outgoing person, but kind of protected himself. And Madlib was more of a shy, maybe socially anxious person who he pretty much, from everyone I talked to, only cares about making music all day. And that shows up in interviews that he has to do for press. So I guess a challenge was writing a book without speaking to either of them, because obviously Doom has passed, and Madlib, I tried to reach out to him, but he didn't want to speak to me for the book. And then ultimately I kind of used that as a way to highlight his mysterious a little bit more. So yeah, I guess I did have some anxieties, apprehensions about writing about these artists, just because I wouldn't want to read someone else writing about them, if that makes sense, even though plenty of people have written about them.
Yep.
And I kind of just chose to write about this album just because it's a great album without really thinking that part of it through.
Yeah.
So cool. I guess I tried in as best a way I could to just, you know, write the book as a fan that, you know, highlights why these artists are great because of that mysteriousness.
Yeah, what'd you write? Just a fan who wants to celebrate Doom, Madlib, and Mad Villainy's eternal unknowability, which I thought was,
yeah, exactly,
was great. What so what is so special? This is a, you know, kind of a very general question, so take it anywhere you want, and as we go through we'll highlight what is so special. But I was wondering if you could speak on what is so special about the album and why you wanted to write about it.
First of all, I mean, it's one of those albums that's just, I use the term undisputed classic.
Yeah.
I'm not the only one that uses that, but it's, you know, an album that I think every track is great, and the sequencing is perfect. Some people might say it's too long. It's 22 tracks, but most of them are short, and it's like, you know, it talks about this a little bit in the book and how none of the songs have hooks or choruses. It's just beats and rapping straight through, but has a thematic consistency of drawing from Doom's mythology of being a supervillain and then combining with Madlib to make a supervillain, Mad Villain. I don't know, it's kind of a generic answer, but it's just a great album. And, you know, it's also like, it's been almost 20 years since it's come out.
Yeah.
And I think the trajectory of the album and its influence is very interesting to me, of how when it came out, it was big in the underground scene. It kind of became a sort of, I don't know, like a lot of people have an identity around Mad Villainy or being a Doom fan or being a Madlib fan, Stone's Throw fan, in that it was almost sort of like, if you know, you know, and if you don't know, like, why don't you know, kind of thing with the album. And even personally, like, I've done a couple other interviews where I've said, like, I admitted I wasn't a huge fan of the album when it first came out, and it took years for me to fully appreciate it. Yeah, so I was just going to say, like, I think, though, also in modern music, all genres, not just hip hop, you kind of can hear the album's influence, and it still sounds like it could have been made today, even though it was made 20 years ago, which is rare for albums. So it's really held up over the test of time.
Yeah, got a timeless feel. I'd write some articles, and we have a series at Across the Margin 20 years later about albums. It always feels like a good point to write about the album. It's like a good period of hindsight to look back and see how it's influenced people and artists, and just kind of get a good grasp on things. So every superhero, every supervillain has an origin story. So I'd love to talk a little bit about each of their origins a little bit, because it does come up in the book. You do a great job of breaking down both Doom and Madlib, where they came from, how they were shaped into the artists they were. So can you tell us a little bit about how Doom's time in Long Beach and his adolescence kind of helped shape him become the artist that he became?
Yeah, so Doom, super interesting that a lot of people have talked about it and different articles you can find online. And if you listen to the albums, he kind of reveals it in different flashes of lyrics and things like that. But for those who don't know, he grew up in Long Beach, New York, which I actually visited Long Beach for the book, just because I wanted to kind of get a sense of what it was like. I'd never been there. I don't know if you've been there. It sounds like you're in.
I have, and I really appreciate the line where you said, like, besides the sign, there was nothing I could really feel about, like, or learn from the area about them.
Yeah. So it's like, I guess I did kind of, I didn't realize it's sort of like suburban, but also from people I talked to who kind of knew Doom growing up, you know, it's close enough to the rest of New York that I think it's like people who grew up there maybe kind of can easily access the city. And
yeah, Long Island like Railroad goes right there. It's like a 40-minute shot to Penn Station or Atlantic Terminal now. Yeah.
Right. So I know. Yeah. And then Doom and his brother, who's Sub Rock, they formed a group called KMD, who, you know, had a hit in the early 90s with Third Base called The Gas Face. And they put out an album signed to a major label, Mr. Hood. And the origin story kind of comes from that, in that when they were working on their second album, Sub Rock, who was primarily did most of the production along with Doom for KMD, he died suddenly while crossing, I think, the Long Island Expressway. It was hit by a car. And then KMD after that was dropped from the label before their second album came out. And there's kind of, the book talks about it, but there's a little controversy about that, because the label Elektra claimed that they dropped KMD because of the album artwork, which Doom drew, which was essentially like, you know, the racist caricature Sambo figure hanging from a noose. And it was kind of tied up with Ice-T, Cop Killer, having controversy before. So from there, you know, Doom essentially faded away, disappeared from the music scene for, I think, 5 or 6 years. And then this is a little before my time, too. So I think people who were hip-hop fans, I was born in 1991, so I wasn't like a KMD fan. I kind of found out about KMD because of Doom, but then in the late 90s, Doom came back wearing a mask and calling himself a superhero and MF Doom, and like this character that he conceptualized, which in a lot of ways is directly influenced by his experience, you know, being on a major label and then being dropped. And so he came back with kind of a defiant attitude that I think resonated with a lot of people. And, you know, for the rest of his life, mostly released albums on, or only released albums on independent labels, not really sticking with one label. And that's pretty much the short version of his origin story.
Absolutely. No, you nailed it. Yeah. The industry had banished him, he wrote. And after his forced absence, he returned with independent vengeance. That was really,
yeah,
really well said. Let's talk Madlib then. Can you tell us a little bit about his upbringing and how Oxnard, California kind of helped? I don't know. It's hard to explain his phenomenal talent, but, you know, learning a little bit about where he came from and how he grew up helps, you know, and that was great insight that you had in the book. Love to hear a little bit about it.
Yeah, so Oxnard is interesting too. I've been there. I actually had an aunt who lived there. She doesn't live there now. I live in LA, and Oxnard is kind of similar. I didn't really connect this until I started writing about the album, but it's sort of obvious. But Oxnard is close to LA, but it's a separate city, but close enough that the industry and everything happening in LA is accessible.
Yeah, you can observe it from afar and but stay grounded, I think, is how you're describing it, which is really.
Yeah. You know. And I think someone else I talked to, some of the other artists from Oxnard who I spoke to, like MED, you know, said it was like
wild child
said, yeah, it was kind of a way to stay humble and grounded, but still be close enough that, you know, could kind of be a part of it. And then from what they did, Oxnard now kind of has a name in the larger music scene.
So
Madlib, like I said, he's someone who seems like a consistent theme of his entire life is he just wants to make music and do nothing else. And his family is very musical. His dad, his real name is Otis Jackson Jr. His dad was Otis Jackson Sr., who was a musician, released some independent albums that you can still find, collaborated with a lot of big name musicians and things like that. His uncle was John Faddis, the jazz musician. And it's from everything I've read, people I've talked to, it seems like, you know, throughout high school, Madlib was just making beats and rapping with his friends and doing the sort of process that he carries with him to this day and just making albums all day, every day. And
he's really obsessed. It's great.
Albums meaning like he would just record beats, maybe rap over them, have other people rap over them, put them on like a tape and then a CD. Now, I guess he says for the past 10 years, he's only ever used an iPad to make beats, which is just hilarious to me. Who knows if it's true, but I believe it.
That's wild.
And so then, he formed a group called the Loot Pack. The other thing I didn't really realize before doing more research is that he's only 2 years younger than Doom, but his career kind of had a slower trajectory because Doom was signed to a major label with KMD when he was a teenager. And for Madlib and the Loot Pack, kind of the origin story that's mentioned a little bit in the book is the group The Alcoholics discovered Madlib rapping off to the side at some party and just immediately was drawn to him and started working with him and the rest of the Loot Pack. And
a
then
parallel to what happened with Doom in third base too.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So very similar trajectories. And then the Loot Pack ended up, and Madlib ended up signing with Stone's Throw, which was a label that was founded in the Bay Area by Peanut Butter Wolf. And eventually Peanut Butter Wolf moved down to LA. And from there, Madlib's career took off in the underground scene. From, you know, he had a support system, I think, from his father, who was, you know, supported his artistic career and kind of allowed him to make beats all day. And then he was able to do that at Stone's Throw as well. And, you know, just built up his name. And then he also kind of went off, and he's someone who, like, when also like Doom, it's like when fans expect one thing, they'll go the exact opposite direction just because that's what they want to do and that makes them happy. So Madlib started a jazz he just was like, I'm not going to do hip hop anymore. And this was after he made his album as Quasimodo, which is another character who essentially he would rap and then speed up his vocals on a tape so it sounded like double speed or whatever, like high pitched.
Yeah.
And apparently there's another kind of legend about that. I think it's mentioned in the book that he recorded that on his own in a week and didn't expect to release it at all. And then Peanut Butter Wolf heard it accidentally on another beat tape that Madlib turned in and was like, you have to put this out. It ended up being a big album. And then from there, he decided, I just want to make jazz. So he started teaching himself how to play instruments and made a fictional jazz group called Yesterday's New Quintet. And that kind of leads up to then Mad Villainy, which was, and also J Lib, his project with J Dilla that he worked on at the same time as Mad Lib.
That's crazy. That's absolutely crazy that they were going at the same time. So as we're going through this, I was kind of laughing there a little bit. Everything's spoken about, you know, like in this legendary way or this uncertain way too, which adds to the legend too. You do a really cool section in the book where you talk about how Mad Villainy is folklore. And you talk about folklore a whole bunch. And I thought that was really important. And I think it'd be really cool to hear you explain what you mean about the album being folklore and being this, you know, enigmatic thing.
Yeah, so that all kind of comes. I took a class in college about folklore that sort of blew my mind. And I never really, you know, you hear the term, but you don't really know what it means, or I didn't really know what it means. On Mad Villainy, Doom has a line where he says, and he always talks in third person for those who don't know, which is just another funny little detail about Doom. But he says his life is like a folklore legend. So he knew that. And I think everyone kind of knows that, but yeah, I wanted to kind of talk about just how, you know, there's a lot of stories about both of these artists and this album in particular. Like originally when I started writing about it, I was interested in how it came out in 2004, which is right before social media really took off. And it was kind of on a label that was focused on vinyl. So it kind of bridges these eras of like, and it also leaked onto the internet before it came out, which is another sort of legend about it.
Turned out to be a good thing as well, which was fascinating. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But at that time, people were kind of like, oh no, an album leaked and you know, this is going to hurt album sales and stuff like that.
Sometimes, yep.
So yeah, to me, it was interesting that it bridged this era of, and it samples a lot from the past of recorded music. So it grew over time because people were talking about it on the internet, on forums like the Stone's Throw message board and in person too, but a lot with the internet kind of just, you know, like what did he mean by this line? And, oh, who is Doom? Is that the guy from KMD? And I kind of relate it to, you know, stories like Bigfoot or Sasquatch, Yeti, stuff like that, where it's like, it's really like the power of it, I guess. First of all, it comes because it's just a great album, but I think it has this special secondary power to it in that people connect with each other by sharing stories about it, and those stories change over time. Mm-hmm. And in some ways, that's credit to the artist because they intentionally crafted it to carry on like that. But now, 20 years after the album came out, it's almost like, you know, the fans have a, I don't want to say ownership, but there is sort of like a, it belongs to everyone because they connect to it and they tell stories about it, if that makes any sense.
No, it absolutely does. What was, you mentioned the leak, what I didn't know this, and it was so fascinating. What he had when Madlib put, you know, a bunch of music on a CD or tape, whatever he was listening to, but the album that leaked was just tracks that he wanted to listen. It was in-flight music. He wanted to listen to it to Brazil, and that's what really got out there. Like everything else that you're speaking to, the way they connect it, which is crucial and important. I mean, we talked about them already being on two coasts. That's kind of unknown, and there's controversy there. So what did you find out about how they connected and started working together?
Yeah, so that's another thing of like relating back to the folklore aspect is, and kind of relating back to this folklore class, and just a real quick history of how that folklore class kind of blew my mind is,
please,
like in, you know, for most of human history, there nothing was recorded. Mm-hmm. So any, you know, a musician, verbal. Yeah, everything was human to human interaction. Like, you know, you think of a medieval person playing a lute or whatever. They were playing a song and someone would hear it. Then they would play another song. Then the printing press was invented and that kind of allowed people to write down stories. And then from there, like identity, nationalistic identities kind of formed. People were writing down folk tales that were passed from human to human. And then jumping forward from the printing press, the internet again kind of made it so people return to like face kind of human to human connection again. Whereas the printing press, I guess what I'm getting at is like there were official narratives mm-hmm. that were written in stone for lack of a better term. Yeah. And then the internet kind of changed that again to where it's human to human, but through a computer.
Yeah.
This doesn't really have anything to do with how Doom and Madlib met, but I guess it kind of just highlights how, you know, there's official
stories there. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And how like sometimes or throughout, I guess, the 20th century, early 21st century, we got kind of accustomed to there being official narratives coming from like institutions and things like that. So when I was interviewing people for the album and doing some research, I found like a lot of the narratives about how they met are kind of, I'm being careful about how I talk about it because in the book, I sort of tried to let people speak for themselves and tell their own stories. But I guess I found like, you know, well, first of all, there's one woman named Walesia Shabazz who she's credited on the album as Allah's reflection. She's performs on Fancy Clown as the voice that you hear in the background. And so she told me that she essentially she's responsible for introducing Doom to Madlib. Mm-hmm. There's also a person in the liner notes named John Doe, who's John Foster. He's an artist who lived in Georgia and knew Doom. And he also knew Egon at Stone's Throw. And he, you know, facilitated the delivery of Madlib's music to Doom in Georgia and showed him that. So I think, and then Egon in the book, who worked at Stone's Throw, doesn't work there now. Mm-hmm. He was very vocal in the book. There's a lot of, I guess, spicy quotes where he's kind of claiming more credit for Mad Villainy than he's been mm-hmm. given in interviews or in write-ups of the album in the past. And so I think, and then the funny thing about how Doom and Madlib met is a lot of people I would talk to who were around at the time were like, oh, I thought Madlib should definitely work with Doom and all this stuff. So it's mm-hmm. like, I think a lot of people who knew both artists understood that if they worked together, it would be great. But I think like Walesia's story in particular hadn't really been told in any like major articles about the album, which I thought was
special. You gave voice to that. That was great.
Yeah. And it's been cool to see the reaction after the book has come out and that mm-hmm. more people are, I guess, at least listening to her side of the story.
Cool. That's really cool. So it's so funny how there's just like this fascinating uncertainty about kind of almost everything involved. in the album. But once they did connect, I thought, and this is, I think this is pretty well known, how they work together from afar, I think is absolutely compelling. It's, I mean, their working relationship, I guess, you know, they did the first three songs, I believe, together out in California. But then, you know, they were working, whether I think Doom was in Georgia at that time, if I'm right from the book. And then obviously Madlib's down in his lair. But can you talk a little bit about the process that they use? It was really interesting at that time. You know, we can't send files back and forth like we can today. So they're working from afar. How'd they do it? How'd they create this being in their different locations?
So like you said, and I kind of try in the book, I try to, I guess, give myself protection from being 100% factually accurate. Sure. By saying this is mostly just from what other people told me, and it may or may not be true, which is kind of the whole theme of the book.
Yep.
But I'm pretty sure this is mostly true, is that Madlib, well, even before agreeing to work with Doom, Madlib had made at least two CDs called 100 Beats, and the second one was like another 100 Beats.
Mm-hmm.
And Stone's Throw had those CDs and was sending them out to a lot of different MCs and trying to get people to rap over them. And so a lot of the Mad Villain beats were on those CDs, and essentially Madlib, Stone's Throw would send them to Doom in Georgia. Doom would also kind of travel all over the place. Like, no one knew where he was or when he would pop up. So he'd be in New York or Georgia or even out in LA. And so he would just, you know, listen to a beat, rap over it, send it back. And then Madlib, I guess I didn't realize this until doing some more research on the album, is that Madlib actually would kind of be a little bit of a more meticulous of an editor than I thought, because a lot of stories about Madlib are just he, you know, makes beats and then throws away whatever sample source he used, completely forgets it and moves on to the next thing and doesn't want to talk about the past. He just fully living in the present moment.
Wow.
And then there's another part that I didn't get to talk about in the book. I mentioned that I didn't get to interview Dave Cooley. I was going to interview him and the timing didn't work out, but he has a recording studio in LA and works a lot with the Stone's Throw people. And I'm very interested in what he did. I don't really know, but he mixed and mastered the album. But I have seen that like Madlib will purposefully, you know, export his tracks onto like a four track or two track thing and mix the way he wants, and he doesn't want people to mess with it after the fact. But it's definitely interesting that they did it from a distance, especially. Definitely. Yeah,
the comparison you used was great. That Postal Service, that band, that duo got a lot of press for doing the same thing that they were doing. Worked out great in both ways. That thing you were talking about, kind of how, I don't know, the production is so fascinating to me. And Money Folder was a great example of that, kind of where that point where that beat drops out. I'd love to talk about some of the music now.
Yeah.
The beat drops out, and then there's that crazy jazz interlude, and Doom kind of uses the simile that about Madlib's ability to flip jazz standards, and that kind of speaks to both of them changing it. Is this the case? They were changing it as it was going back and forth. They were each adding their touches and changing it, and you said it perfectly. They were speaking to each other through the music without even sitting down like a band would do and going over things. That's remarkable.
Yeah, it's definitely remarkable. And I feel like, too, like at the time and even today, when you hear two artists collaborating, there's kind of a, at least in my mind, I'm like, oh, but they, now it's really common to, you know, send beats and verses back and forth. But even now it's like, oh, well, they weren't actually in the studio together, so it kind of loses quality or something like that. But for this album, I think it makes it better because from what Doom and Madlib have both said in different interviews over the years, is like, they said, you know, we speak to each other through the music and we don't need to be in the same room to be communicating with each other, which is great. Doom also, side note, when he passed away, there was a meme, not a meme, but a screenshot of a interview he did at one point. I haven't been able to find it since originally, but it's a great, like, where he talks about how he still talks to his brother, he still talks to Jay Dilla, like, kind of in a spiritual sense, and that, like, even though they're not there, they're physically there, they're still with him. And I think, even though, like, obviously Madlib and Doom were both alive, I think there was, like, a spiritual connection for lack of a better term. And, like, even when they were together, they weren't even in the same room really at all, except for their first meeting. It's like Doom would just be writing on the deck of the Stone Storehouse, and Madlib, like you said, would be in the bomb shelter. I think Madlib too did a lot of production. It's not like the only song that Doom is credited as a producer on is the first track, which is similar to KMD's albums and Operation Doomsday, MF Doom's first album, in that it's like got a cartoon narrators from comic books and TV shows that are sort of stitched together, which is something Doom and Sub Rock did really well. And I think Madlib did a little bit too. They're not the only people who have done it. It's like Prince Paul and even RZA and stuff like that. But I think Madlib kind of pays homage to Doom in a lot of ways on the album, which is cool. But I don't know how much Doom really did himself. For Fancy Clown, Walasia, who I mentioned before, said that Doom put her vocal snippets throughout the track and then sent that back to Madlib, and I'm sure Madlib rearranged it himself also.
It's just remarkable. Let's talk about another track real quick. I'm obsessed with accordion, and you wrote most hip hop producers wouldn't sample an accordion like sound for a beat. Most rappers wouldn't choose to rap over that beat. Name check the instrument in one of its most memorable lines and name a song after it. Can you talk about how unique a hip hop track accordion is?
Yeah, accordion is, like, I think still it's probably, I want to say objectively, maybe the best song on the album, but obviously objectively is just my own bias. Sure. But, you know, it's essentially after that intro, it's essentially the first song on the album. And it's, I talked to Daedalus, who is a producer that was sampled for that song. And apparently it's actually not an accordion. It's like a little toy, almost organ. Yeah. That they used on that. And and then I talked to another person who's mentioned a lot in the book, B+, who's a legendary photographer in the hip hop scene, who told me that the accordion is the first synthesizer, which I can't remember if I put that in the book, but I don't even know if that's true or not.
Cool. Yeah, it's a cool statement.
I love it.
Cool
idea. Yeah. And then I have heard from other people, you know, like different cultures where accordion is kind of a bigger part of music history and culture. So, but to me, it's just, you know, accordion has like a really harsh sound, not the smooth jazz sound that like hip hop of that time, especially, you know, what Madlib kind of favors and Doom. But yeah, I don't know. I'm not really saying anything insightful about it.
No,
but
what was cool, you mentioned that toy organ that does it. And it was, you can kind of like, when the, it was, I think you mentioned how the air, when it goes over it, over the, you can almost hear the keys a little bit too. Like,
yeah,
over it. I just thought that was super insightful. It's no, it just, it is such, it's so unique. And I kind of probably stole your thunder with using your line there about how unique it is with, you know, that they're choosing to rap over this beat, choosing to talk about accordion. It's wild. But what's funny is you did mention it, and it's probably my favorite song on it, accordion, but Dr. Truthiverse, one of your characters in the book, believes that All Caps is maybe the greatest song of all time. Is that's one of your other favorites? That's a special song.
That's a great song. And the other thing with Mad Villainy is, and I think I mentioned this in the book too, is that, you know, every time I listen to it, I end up coming out with a different song, a different favorite song or a song that I think is the best. Mm. Yeah, All Caps is, that beat is just amazing. And then that song directly led ties in sort of to the folklore of after that song came out, then everyone who was a Doom fan suddenly was like, oh, you have to spell Doom's name with all caps. And yeah, just I don't even really have anything to say about that song either, except
You
it's just a
know
great
what?
song.
I was thinking a lot about it because you do mention how there were zero hooks on, all the 45 minutes. But you mentioned it really hit home. But it feels like hooks sometimes. And all caps is one that really speaks to that. Like every time when he gets back to us, say all caps, it really feels like a hook. But there are no hooks on this entire, which is just crazy.
Yeah, I think I wrote it again in the book, quoting myself, but it's like he says Doom will say something like, just remember all caps when you spell the man's name. And then, the beat follows that. And like the way that he says it at the moment he says it, it really sticks in your mind, like you said, as or even on
Feels
accordion.
it.
It's like, yeah, like
Feels
when he
it.
says accordion, you think of like, oh yeah, like the chorus is accordion or whatever.
It's not. It's crazy. So what do you think, to kind of bring this home a little bit, the kind of now, and we were talking about that hindsight and looking back, and kind of it's a good opportunity to see who it's affected, how it's changed music, which it has. But what would you say is kind of like the ultimate influence of the album or even the artist, as now that we look at it, like who it's affected, how it's changed, I could say music and music generally, but like how it's changed hip hop would probably be more pointed. But what's the influence of this tremendous game-changing album?
Yeah, well, I think the no hooks thing is kind of, you see that a lot now, and especially underground hip hop. I mentioned Odd Future in the book because I was a big fan of Odd Future when they were first coming out, and especially like both Tyler the Creator and Earl Sweatshirt. But I think Earl Sweatshirt especially is, both of them have directly stated that Doom was a big influence on them.
I'm glad you mentioned that moment. It gave me chills when I first saw it, that video when they got a chance to meet Doom, and just their pure enthusiasm, their pure joy of meeting Doom was, honestly, gave me chills, almost welled up. It was awesome.
No, that is great because you can just tell that they're so happy to meet their hero or a villain, whatever. But I think too, it's like interesting now we're saying, 20 years later, is that Doom, and I think his death has only heightened this, is that he's become even more of a mythological figure, almost like I don't know, Kurt Cobain, John Lennon type of thing, where it's like younger people now, kids who are in high school on TikTok, like Doom is a popular artist on TikTok. And people are finding out about the album years later and still coming back to it and then seeing how it has influenced the music that they've grown up with. And then, like, obviously, to people who are in their 40s, 50s, who are around when it came out, to them, it's still like a, crucial artist and album, Matt Villainy. And then I guess there's also like, Doom's not the only person who concealed his identity. Like, I was thinking a lot about Gorillaz, which is, now that I'm saying that, I can't remember if Gorillaz was happening in around 2004, but I almost feel like,
Close.
yeah, like
Yeah, that was,
it might not be directly influenced, but, and then there's people like younger hip hop artists who will hide their face and sort of stuff like that. And then I think there's people who don't draw from it as directly, but definitely try to like make that world, that mystique around themselves.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I don't know if Jay Electronica might sound like he does, and Griselda talks about him a lot. Danny Brown talks about him a lot. Tom York talks about him a lot. I wanted one more point before we kind of wrap this up, but I love how you really get into how he's funny. But more than that, and I'm talking about Doom specifically here. I appreciate it. So many people talk about how he kind of has a stream of consciousness, kind of this collage of words and things, but you really got into, on multiple occasions, how calculated these word choices were. And I thought that was important in the respect to his craft. I mean, he wasn't just putting these crazy lines together. I mean, he was revising it, can you speak on that just a little bit? I just think it's so important to his legacy.
Yeah, definitely. I'm glad you pointed that out too, because like, you know, stream of consciousness is something you hear a lot, or you hear like, oh, Doom, he raps off beat. Like people, I think now that's
an undercut. Yeah.
Yeah. And like now that's considered like, oh, he was doing it on purpose, so that's a good thing. But I think maybe at the time, and even for myself, I like didn't fully, I guess, understand everything he was doing. But there's definitely a lot of intention and subtle nuance to the way that he formed his verses. And also like his editing process as well, because both Doom and Madlib, I guess they seem on the surface as these people who just don't care a lot. Not that they don't care, but it's like they keep it loose, which is something that attracted me to the music in the first place as well. Yeah. And like it sounds very raw, and that's intentional as well. But like even we mentioned the leak, after the album leaked, Doom re-recorded all of his verses, and he intentionally changed the tone of his voice.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is super interesting when you go back and compare the two versions of the, like the leaked version.
Some people didn't like it. What did you say? They had demoitis?
Yeah, I guess that's what I think Peanut Butter Wolf or Egon from Stones Throw said that. Because it's like they had heard, you know, him rapping in this one voice that he used on his first album, and then he completely changed it, and it's like, wait, what's going on here?
Yeah.
But I think like accordion is a great example of how that kind of voice works a lot better, because it's subtle, but it is like lower and calmer. Maybe it's not as much of a, like you mentioned Danny Brown, when you hear Danny Brown talking versus how he raps. It's like, I mean, he does kind of talk like he raps too, but you know, he uses a really active, high pitch kind of rapping voice.
Yeah.
Whereas Doom on Mad Villainy is more laid back, I guess. But yeah. And then like even down to specific lines, like would change from the leak version to the final version. Yeah. And I think that just goes to show, like how Doom was very meticulous and thoughtful into every word.
Yep.
And also another kind of side point off that is just how, you know, a lot of Doom's lines, like he'll say something that's almost like a joke. Like, I forget what song it's on, but it's like one thing this party could use is more booze, where it's like booze doesn't rhyme. You think he's going to say something else.
Yeah, yeah.
And then it's like a total flip that kind of makes you laugh. And that's like a really funny line. But then on like Meat Grinder, for example, he's like saying stuff that even now I can't really understand what he's saying, or like it takes a ton of listens to unlock what he's actually saying. So it's really, I guess it's like poetic, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a lot to dig into. I'd like to close here with a quote I just think's outstanding from one of your characters, Dr. Truthiverse. Mad Villainy's is the best album of all time. That is a lie, because the truth, it is not an album. It's a legend that continues to breathe life into a community of listeners, spawning variations of stories with distinct meaning for each individual that hears them and shares them. MF Doom died, and like you and I, Madlib will. Mad Villainy cannot. That's great, man. That's a really, really cool line. Will, you really helped me understand an album I've loved a lot for a long, long time. It's a great read, and I'm glad to talk about it with you. So thank you for coming on the program. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I appreciate it as well.
So nasty, that is probably somewhat of a travesty having me. Then he told the people, you can call me your majesty. keep your battery charged. He know it won't stick, yo, and it's not his fault you kick slow. Shoulda let your trick hold, chick hold your sick glow. Plus nobody couldn't do nothing once he let the brick go. And you know I know, that's a bunch of snow. The beat is so butter, peep the slow cutter as he utter the calm flow. Don't talk about my mom, yo. Sometimes he rhyme quick, sometimes he rhyme slow, or vice versa. Whip up a slice of nice verse pie, hit it on the first try, villain. The worst guy, spot hot tracks like spot a pair of fat asses. Shots of the scotch from out the square shot glasses. And he won't stop till he got the masses. And show him what they know not through flows of hot molasses. Do it like the robot to head spin to boogaloo. Took a few minutes to convince the average boogaloo. It's ugly, like look at you, it's a damn shame. Just remember all caps when you spell the man name.
Osiris.
This podcast is in the loop, the Legion of Osiris podcasts. Osiris is creating a community that connects people like you with live experiences and podcasts about artists and topics you love. Get in the loop at osirispod.com.